Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour for November 8th, 2018. Many topics to cover tonight, including a little bit about an object that was rare, a rare object. It was called Oumuamua, which was discovered by a pan-star telescope located on the island of Hawaii. It was a long, like needle-looking object as it whizzed through the solar system in the year 2017. It was discovered in October of 2017. Now, a group of astronomers from Harvard University are claiming, sit down, folks, I thought our astronomers were against anything dealing with aliens, but nope, they're saying that this could have been an alien spacecraft or something sent to discover if Earth had a population or intelligent life or something like this. So anyway, you know, all of this is wonderful, but these people are being paid. And the bottom line is this object has come and gone. It's not visible anymore. And there's no evidence of any kind to support what they're saying. It's just an unusual object. It's long and thin, and that's about it. There's, you know, nobody saw windows. Nobody saw little green men peeking over the top of the window. Nobody saw any indication of intelligent life of any kind associated with this object. It was turning end over end, which allowed them to make some measurements, determine that it was much longer than it was wide. It was something like, I forget, many, 10 times longer than it was wide. So it's not a normal asteroid-looking object. But to somehow say that this is related to an alien race in a distant planetary system sending a probe to see, to inspect us here on Earth is beyond ridiculous. Also, it did not come very close to Earth. You would think if they were going to take all the time to send something through interplanetary space or interstellar space, excuse me, to visit Earth, that it would, and they wanted to look at Earth, that they would send it a bit closer. So anyway, but the bottom line is there's no evidence for what they're saying. And that's the issue. It's like, let me take another example of something in the science world that is repeated over and over again, called the Oort cloud. It was hypothesized by a guy named Oort, I think it was back in the 1800s, when they were trying to explain certain comets that would come into the solar system and their orbits. Their orbits terminated out in a certain region, a very broad region, not even a ring-like region, but just a kind of a spherical region around the solar system. And allegedly it was out there great distance from the solar system. But the only problem is nobody could ever detect it. Nobody ever will detect it. Even if you could get a telescope out in that region of the best telescope that you could imagine building, you still couldn't see these comets because they're so sparse or sparsely sprinkled through this alleged region of space. So by no stretch of the imagination in today's world or in the lifetime of anybody alive today could they ever imagine detecting the Oort cloud. I just saw a video the other day. A woman is like very excited talking about comets and the Oort cloud and how they, all of these, I mean, it was just absurd. But it's fairy tale science. Somebody tells people to say this. They read it in a textbook, so it must be true. And but anyway, the idea that this object, Oumuamua, was somehow an alien spacecraft sent by aliens from another star system to examine Earth is preposterous. And let's go back a number of years. Let's go back to 1995. There was a group of people out in Los Angeles that they called themselves Heaven's Gate. and they were awaiting an alien spacecraft to come here from another star system, and they were ridiculed by to the nth degree by these same astronomers, that, oh, how ludicrous you could imagine this. So I guess if you're an astronomer, you can say that there's an alien spacecraft sent by aliens from another star system to investigate Earth. But if you're not, then you can't. It's laughable. It's actually just laughable. The problem is these people are getting paid, and probably from some of your taxed, hard-earned tax money. Here's another one that a group of scientists, this comes up every now and then, a group of scientists want to send laser signals out into the great unknown, into outer space and beyond, to signal to aliens that we are here, that the human race is, you know. And so problem is, not a very good idea. Let me ask you a question. If the Aztecs or the Incas or the Maya, primarily the Aztecs and the Incas, if they had a capability of radioing to Europe and saying, hey, everybody, we're over here. Hey, here we are. We're a developed community. And, you know, by the way, we got a lot of gold, natural resources. Do you think that would have been a very good idea to signal the Incas and the Aztecs, signal Europe going, hi, we're over here, by the way. Come and get us, you know, come and visit. Pay us a visit, would not have been a very good idea. Because if you look at the end result of what happened when the Spanish primarily and the Portuguese and others finally made it, the French, you know, the Dutch and the, well, all of the other trading companies that went in and pillaged and robbed everything blind from the Incas and Aztecs and killed them, brought disease. Do you think it would have been a good idea for them to radio to Europe and say, you know, back in the earlier days, remember that it was about the time that Columbus crossed the ocean and made the first discovery that the Europeans were getting the space or the seafaring technology to actually cross the ocean. So anyway, not a good idea. So sending signals out to notify other alien races that were here, not a good idea. Okay, just a quick mention. A number of weeks ago, in late October, I was awarded, and my company and my work, it was the annual XPRIZE Technology Innovation Achievement Award for the wing generator and the water machines, my own product line of water machines, that were used in the Water Abundance XPRIZE. So anyway, that was an amazing accomplishment. And in regard to the wing generator, it's moving forward. We're getting very ready now to start placing 10 kilowatt and 50 kilowatt systems. And so the 10 kilowatt is what I call the farm ranch model. And some of you may have written in, and this may be over the past year, some have written in saying, hey, I'd like to maybe get one of these. You have a farm or a ranch. You might have a farm where you're milking, say, a few hundred cows a day or something, and your electric bill is really high. Or you have a ranch. You're out at the end of the power line. You have terrible service, you pay an exorbitant amount of money, or say on an island or away from the, you have a community that's away from the power stations, etc. And so your electric bills are high, you have unreliable power. And by the way, these are not for individual houses, they're way too big. This is for somebody that has serious electrical usage. And so anyway, the 10 kilowatt model and the 50 kilowatt model being commercialized. And also I'm looking for qualified investors that would be interested in funding some of the other projects, 13 projects total. And these would be in the, you know, $4 to $40 million range. So you never know. You never know who's listening out there. And people that may be, you know, in a position to be on the ground floor in a, this emerging company, emerging technology. And by the way, if people are out there, and I was on Power Hour yesterday with Daniel Brigman, and we were talking offline about this. And anyway, discussing the scam artists out there. And I've been around the block too many times. I've been kicked around the block more times than I've walked around the block, probably. And so I'm pretty savvy regarding scam artists or investors who want to take something for a ride, get something for nothing or whatever. So anyway, this is for real investors with real interest and real interest on return in, on investment, very good return on investment. So, and by the way, the webpage, which is still being updated, is jmccwing.com. So I have, by the way, just let you know, I have a number of webpages. The main one related to this show is jmccsci.com or jmccanniscience.com. The short version, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. And that's where I have my water filters for sale, etc. The books, the CDs, DVDs, all of my published work. Okay, so anyway, just that's just a little note on that. That's moving ahead nicely. Money always makes things move faster, but then again, money usually comes with strings attached. So I would just say that in the next months, years, and decades to come, you're going to be seeing more and more of the wing generator. And I'll just make one comment. It's working much better than I had anticipated. So that's just a fact that the measured output is much better than I anticipated. And by the way, it's patented, trademark, patents pending, a lot of legal work that goes along with this. And so, you know, that it is not for like home hobbyists, things like that. I'm not interested in dealing with that level of development. At this point, we're just looking for investors to take this to the next increased level of manufacturing. Okay, so enough of that. A little political note, Jeff Sessions resigned. They asked me to comment about this on the Power Hour yesterday, but a few extra comments. Wow, this was one of President Trump's biggest mistakes, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. It did not help anybody out because it basically locked the whole judicial entity of the United States, which is under the executive branch. This is not the Supreme Court. This is not the three balance of power positions of the federal government. This is the Justice Department, which falls under the president executive branch of government. But basically, for 2 years, it has been spinning its wheels. And so it'll be interesting to see who gets appointed in place of Jeff Sessions. And I think we're going to see, because the Democrats took the House, and if you're a Democrat, you'll probably be very happy about that. But as I mentioned on the Power Hour yesterday, all of the indications of cheating in these large population centers around the upper the Northwest states, the area around the Bay Area in California, the Southern California region, the big cities of Texas, a couple Midwestern cities, and then a few Eastern cities, including New York, produced, because the House of Representatives is based on population, these have produced 219 Democrat House of Representative constituents to come into the new Congress. very interesting that a very small portion of the country is contributing the vast majority of, or the majority, let's say, not vast majority, but majority, voting majority of the House of Representatives. And you don't see that happening in the Senate. And that's because the way districting occurs as opposed to the state level senator races. But anyway, be that as it may, I think there has to be some serious investigating into cheating at the local level. And what I've discovered is that it's primarily at the precinct level where they actually are falsifying vote results at the precinct level. So all the votes come in, all the votes are counted, the boxes are sealed, and then at the very end, somebody writes down the number of votes, and it's incorrect. I'm not going to go into more of that. But anyway, it'll be interesting to see what comes down in the future. But and also this issue of impeachment, I want to clarify. If you read Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution that deals with impeachment, the House of Representatives would start any impeachment processes, but it is the Senate that has to vote by two-thirds majority, so that would be 67 votes, and to actually carry out the impeachment. So the House of Representatives can jump up and down and do all the investigating at once, but it has to pass two-thirds majority, a supermajority of the Senate, not a simple majority, which would be one vote over 50%, but a supermajority, which is 67 out of 100, so 66.6667 being the percentage, or the two-thirds majority, and then more than that would be 67 votes. So there were two times, just to give you a little background here, there were actually three times in history where there was a vote to impeach a president. One of them was Bill Clinton, and they actually sent it to impeach him, and the Senate rejected it. There were only 45 votes in favor of impeaching Bill Clinton back when he was president. So he continued, even though there was a motion to impeach Clinton, the Senate blocked it by not having enough votes. They needed 67 votes. Okay, and then, of course, Richard Nixon resigned before the Senate vote, which they estimated would have been 100-0 because of the Watergate and all of those issues. But Richard Nixon never was impeached because he quit before they could impeach him. Anyway, little bit of fun facts there. But in terms of impeachment process, the House of Representatives would make any accusations of what is known as high crimes, treason, bribery, treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors. And so anyway, that's a rather vague term, and the history of that wording is rather vague because they did not want impeachment to turn into a political tool where if the president was there and there was a majority in the House of Representatives, that there would always be a constant impeachment process no matter what. They would try and find something that he did and misdemeanor and try and throw him out of office, and it would turn into this political tool, which now it has, actually. Anyway, just a little bit of history on the concept of impeachment. But once again, the House of Representatives creates the draft of the Articles of Impeachment and then sends it to the Senate, and the Senate then holds the trial, if you want to call it that. It's not really a trial, but it holds the hearings regarding, and then it has to vote 67, and that's probably not going to happen. In fact, you could pretty much say right off the top that that's not going to happen. So as far as impeaching Trump, people can talk about it all they want, but it's going to be a futile effort. But the end result is we're going to see a lot of chaos in government, in the federal level here, over the next at least 2 years, and until the next election, which is the four-year presidential election, plus a lot of congressmen. And what's interesting, one other interesting point about this past election was the huge number of Republicans who quit and left office and left this huge void, which was then soaked up by the Democrats winning 27 seats, which gave them the majority. So anyway, that is a strange, something that's never happened before, that number of one party or another leaving office at the midterm, leaving pretty much an open slate for this election to fill up with the opposing party. Okay, so anyway, but the prognosis for the next 2 years is one of utter chaos and actually nothing getting done in the House of Representatives and Congress. Between the two of them, you know, you can pretty much predict nothing is going to get done. Okay. Which brings up a point. It's almost as if the United States needs a two-tier system of government. But if you do that, then you'd need a three-tier, then a four-tier, then a five-tier. And you would need every identity politics group having to have their own government to run their own issues. And so since that's just a path to chaos, the two-party system is actually the one that's worked in England for all that time. By the way, I did get a kick. There was in the 1600s, there was a king, there was a prince, I believe, and the House of Commons set up to impeach him, and it turned out he was not able to be impeached because of his stature as royalty. And the position of the royalty was that they were appointed by God. They were adorned by God to be in their position, and they could not be thrown out of office. And so that's interesting, because remember that it was the church, originally the Catholic Church, and then when the Protestant Reformation came in, the Protestant Church, but it was the church who anointed the king, giving the people the belief that the king was anointed by God. And so unlike administrators in the House of Commons or the House of Lords, where the people were elected, or the prime minister, for example, in England are elected. But the royalty in England, which we did away with, in fact, the Constitution is very clear that there are no entitlements, there are no titles that would be honored under the Constitution. So that's a very interesting thing. In other words, they were doing away with royalty in the United States Constitution, that all people were created equal. You did not have this royalty class, which had royalty status and were, you know, as they see it, appointed by God and above everything else. Although there are some people in the United States that seem to get away with almost anything and enjoy some kind of royalty status. Okay, enough of that. Dealing with comets, I've been watching two comets, and I'll be talking more about them in the future. One will be coming in this December, and one will be coming in the year 2022. So I'll have more on those in upcoming weeks. But I found it rather comical that this past week NASA put out a study and actually made a big deal about it, that they were trying to figure out why certain comets would exhibit multiple tails. And they came to the amazing conclusion that particles in the tail were charged, and this somehow interacted with local magnetic fields in the solar system to somehow separate the tails out. So you can see here the creeping crud, as I call it, trying to inch into the plasma discharge comet model territory as, you know, just I liken it to, remember the scene where the dog lives outside and gets to sleep on the porch. But then the dog inches up to the door and then puts one paw in the door. Looks around, nobody says anything. Pretty soon there's two paws in the door. And then, you know, a little bit of one of the, up to the first elbow of the dog in the house. Nobody says anything. What the dog is doing is creeping into the house, trying to, little bit, and this dog is intelligent enough to know that he can, if he breaks the rule just a little bit, he can get away with it, and then break it a little more, and it's like a kid, you know, a kid that wants to get his way. It just, you know, moves a little bit, and then, okay, now I'm a little more. And that dog is intelligent enough to know then pretty soon that dog is in the kitchen. And it's, oh, I guess the dog can stay in the kitchen. Pretty soon he's laying on the couch, you know. Anyway, that's what the creeping crud is all about, and that's what NASA is doing. They're slowly creeping into the James McCanney plasma discharge comet model world view of comets. And this is kind of a back door way in to do it, looking at comets with multiple tails. But if you look at my work, very clearly I already talk about this issue and how they form in the multiple tails, and especially the comet Hale-Bopp. I've got a great deal of analysis on the comet Hale-Bopp, which to the naked eye did not have multiple tails, but if you looked under certain filters of light, then you would see the multiple tails out there swinging around like giant snakes, actually snaking around and snapping and joining together, etc. And I explain how that happens because something known as the pinch effect, and that's enumerated in my very early work, always copied but never duplicated, of course. But interesting that NASA is finally trying to get the creeping crud moving on the issue of comet tails. That appeared in space.com, which, of course, is a controlled mouthpiece of NASA. So anyway, in the next few weeks, I'll be talking more about the two comets, the December 21st close approach to Earth comet, and this is, I talked about in past weeks, I've talked about this comet, that we may come close enough to have an electrical interaction with this comet. We may not. It may be far enough away. It's impossible to tell because NASA does not use its technology to give us real information about what is known as Debye shielding. This is the electrical sheath, a spherical sheath that surrounds the charged comet nucleus. Okay. But, okay, the main topic tonight I want to talk about is dealing with survival. Now, the other night I watched a movie, and then the night after that I watched it again, which was very interesting. The name of the movie was Everest. So some of you may have seen this. If not, it's a nail-biter type of movie in which, I believe the year was 1994 or 96, something like that, there was a commercial venture which was taking groups of people to climb Mount Everest. And this one particular tour went very much awry. Let's just put it that way. And as I watched this the first time, I thought, wow, this is a clear-cut case of what not to do in a survival situation. These people clearly did not have it together. And the leader, one of the biggest problems was that the leader, this guy named Rob, lost control of his group. He was the leader, he was in charge, and he told the people in the group that were one by one failing in this quest to climb Mount Everest, they one by one decided that they wanted to do something different, and because they wanted to do it because it was for them, and not realizing that they were putting the entire group at risk. And a lot of them ended up dying. I think there was a total of 5 that died in this. But it all, the end result is that none of them had to die. And it was due to a couple of the team members not following the instructions of the leader. And so why am I talking about this? Because in a real survival situation, you have to have a leader that you trust. And you have to have a leader that when the leader says something, you do this, or you go there, or you don't do this, you don't continue, then the people have to do that because that person is there for a reason. It gets a little more sketchy when you get down to personal survival. Say that you are caught in an emergency, or say there's a national emergency or whatever. Or a localized emergency like a hurricane or an earthquake or some kind of an event, and you're left there with whatever you've got, and that's it, and a bunch of other people. And in that situation, things get a little more dicey. They're not as clearly defined. Who the leader is, etc. And so, remember back during the Obama days, people were criticized for being survivalists or preppers. And now, since Trump was in, you don't hear too much. John Moore has a prepper tip of the day every day on his radio show. But you don't hear so much anymore about preppers. You don't have the BLM crashing down doors, assaulting people on their ranches. You find people actually relaxing a bit. You don't have that Gestapo type of, jackboot, infiltration into groups like you had back then. The concept that was you versus the government has gone away. That may return a little bit, but the BLM and other departments that were acting that way, that has gone away. So that you see a real relaxing in what was previously called the prepper community. And there were even TV shows mocking people who were preppers, making them look in like a bunch of crazy lunatics that were, trying to, create a havoc while there was none or something. Anyway, it was a mockery from the liberal left community, if you want to put it that way. But anyway, most of that has gone by the wayside. But there are still natural disasters, natural events that you could become caught in someday and be left with to your own devices. Even though with hurricanes, there's federal relief, etc., but on an individual level, the big shiny government truck is still not going to come down, park in front of your house, and unload all kinds of survival gear for you. This is not going to happen. But regarding the psychology of survival, a lot of people would go out and take the food that you might have and prepare a big meal, and everybody come on in and eat, and then the next day there'd be no food left. You have to have people who are really with a good understanding of what it's going to take to survive the upcoming days, weeks, or possibly months, or years if it really got bad. And what you have to do, a lot of people are off on their own trip and tangent, and that's the issue. So going back to the movie Everest, the movie starts out, they arrive in I forget where it is, Kathmandu or wherever. Then they have to take a train, and then they start walking and crossing bridges over rivers, etc., starting to hike up the mountain. And this whole process takes a couple months of moving up to higher camp, then a higher camp, and then et cetera. But you can see personality-wise, one by one, these people are individuals, and the leader of the teams, there are actually four teams of about 10 to 20 people each that are all there at the same time, who all want to go to the summit on the same day, which causes some conflicts. But then there's some other groups that go up there, and it looks like they remove ropes, et cetera, so that the following groups have a tough time crossing these very difficult passages where you need ropes, et cetera. And it's pretty hair-raising when you see some of these locations. But on the ascent, one by one, people start having problems. And when they do, the leader says, okay, your trip's over. You got to go back down. Now, why is he saying that? Is he saying it because, and apparently these people paid a lot of money, like $65,000 to go on this trip. And so their attitude is, I paid this money, I'm going to go. And, you know, their attitude is that it's not a team effort. This is all about them. And that is the major problem that occurs in this movie. And so the one guy has trouble with his eyesight. And so the leader says, okay, you're done. You got to go back down. And he goes, well, no, I want to go up. I think I can do this. And so anyway, he stays there. That guy ends up eventually getting back of his own motivation, getting back to one of the base camps where they take him out in a helicopter, which, by the way, puts other people at risk. The helicopter pilot went through a lot of risk to go up and get him off the mountain so he could get medical treatment. And so the end result is that he also put other people at risk and basically was a one-man walking problem for the rest of the group. They actually made it to the top with a couple of the people who had paid to go up to Mount Everest. They make it all the way to the top, and so they're coming back down, and this one guy, Doug, is lagging way behind. He's having serious problems. He's out of oxygen, but he sees that Mount Everest, the peak, is about, you know, a short, maybe a couple hundred yards away. So he's almost there. He's been there before and not been able to make it all the way to the top. So the leader of the group, this Rob guy, goes, hey, your trip's over. Sorry, man, you didn't make it again. And this guy goes, "That I'll never have a chance again. This is it. This is my last time." And so Rob, the leader, breaks down, goes against his own rule that they should be descending because they knew bad weather was moving in. They had a short window to get back down. In that time that it took them to go up to the top again with this Doug guy, and then Doug starts having physical problems. He can't move. He's out of oxygen. His body is breaking down. So instead of leaving him and coming back for help later, Rob decides to stay with him. He's not going to leave his client up there on the mountain alone. And so by making these bad decisions, the leader put himself in a risk and eventually ends up dying himself. And now let's take this whole scenario back. By the way, eventually, let's go back a little bit. Three of the men from the group decided to come down early. They did not go all the way to the top. They realized that there was problems. Some of the essential ropes were missing, and there was a backlog trying to cross this one critical narrow strip of the mountain. So these three guys just headed back, and they made it all the way to one of the upper base camps, but still, they were out of gas when they got back. And I'll tell you something personally. I have done some mountain climbing myself, and I wouldn't call it mountain climbing, I would call it mountain walking, up to higher elevations. One time it was when I was in Mexico. I was climbing the Popocatepetl, one of the volcanoes. I went out with a group of people, and I got there behind the other groups. So I could see them up on the slope, maybe 1,000 yards up above me. And I went up, and I started walking up myself. And, of course, Mexico City itself is about 7,000 feet. And so we were probably 10 to 12,000 feet above sea level. And so moving up, 10 to 12,000 feet, somewhere in that range, all of a sudden, my body just came unglued. I had diarrhea. My blood pressure dropped, and all kinds of things happened to your body at those elevations. And so I was to the point where I was really weak, and I could hardly move. I was able to get back down, and there was no threat. It was cold. It was windy. But after a time, I got my abilities back. But if you're up at those high altitudes and you are out of oxygen, your body starts doing things that, you just don't have energy. You just don't have the ability to move. And so by not following the order of the leader, these people put themselves and all of the other people at risk, because now the leader, instead of concentrating on the people who did need help to get back down the mountain, was stuck with one guy who was obstinate. He wanted to do this for himself. And that is the problem. You have to work as a group. The guy should have said, "No, I cannot help you out to get to the top, even though it's a couple hundred yards away. I cannot help you out because I got to get back down and help these other people who are going to need help getting back down the mountain. I cannot leave 10 or 15 other people of my group to help you because you want to be an individual, because you have something in your mind and that's what you want to do, but it doesn't coincide with the welfare of the group as a whole." So, anyway, coming back to general survival situations, and this can happen in a flash. You might be thinking, "Well, I'm not going to be in a survival situation." Anybody could on a moment's notice. A lot of people in flooding situations, they were walking around the day before, going shopping, whatever, and all of a sudden they're in a survival situation. Look at the Carolinas. Look at other places that, all of a sudden there's a storm moving in. You have a couple days' notice, and boom, you are thrown into a survival situation. And now you're dealing with the same level of, who's in charge? What do we do? How much food do we have? Do we have clean water? Do we have access to clean water? The essential things that you need. It might be weeks, et cetera. I talked to people who were in the Houston hurricane down there. It was weeks until they could recover. I myself was in the Hurricane Irma issue in Florida about a year ago. It was in August of 2017. And, a lot of people were leaving Florida. So, the gas stations, the convenience stores, the grocery stores were being cleaned out by people who normally were not there. But, now the local people try and go to the grocery store and there's nothing there. Most cities have about 6 to 10 hours at most of food on the shelves. If everybody went in and started buying, they wouldn't have enough food. They would run out, and then no more trucks are coming in to resupply the grocery stores. And so, literally everything is, the shelves go bare, and that's the way they sit. That's it. There's nothing more. So it's people, even with bottled water, are not prepared. As far as bottled water, I'm very much against people getting bottled water. What you should have is a water filter. But be that as it may, that's just one aspect. Water is just one aspect of your survival. But back to the mental, the psychological aspect of surviving an event, people have to be oriented towards the group. I can tell you there are people that you do not want to be with in a survival situation. They'll lose it. They come in glued. They have problems. Everything has got to focus on them. And, you know, they will take all the food and eat it because, you know, they're people in survival situations become different people. And then there are people who you think, oh, those people would be really not good. They turn out to be the ones that are, you know, really on top of everything, in control, etc. So it's hard to say. And I've been in situations where there are emergencies, and what you would think would be people who would be stable in an emergency situation completely come unglued. And once people are in that state, once people are in that state where they lose it or they know they're losing it, and they think they want to be in control, they're very difficult people to deal with. They're very difficult to manage. You cannot say anything to them because they're off. They're only focused on themselves. They can't realize that their own survival depends on the group survival. So very important to analyze this. So I suggest you take a look at this movie. It's called Everest. And just look at... Now, let's go back. Here's what I want to express about this. Let's go back in the beginning. You start out with 20 people, seasoned mountain climbers. They're in a group. You're going up a mountain. And one by one, they start to have problems. Okay, at that point, you got to say to the people, okay, you're done. You know, we cannot risk the group because you paid $65,000 and you're not... Each one of these people had a vision of getting to the top of Mount Everest, and they were very intent on it. This is not just the money, it's the motivation, it's the belief that they can do this. And then, of course, some of them had motivations to show other groups of people that were back, you know, where they came from, to show them that they could actually do this. So there were lots of motivations, but they were primarily all personal. I didn't hear a single person when they were going around telling what their motivation was for climbing the mountain. Not a single one of them mentioned anything about the group. But they all had to go in a group because by themselves, they simply would not have made it. Not by any stretch of the imagination, they would not have made it. So the point is that these people are all individuals. So going back to the beginning, as they were going up the mountainside, as people began to have problems, it was like, okay, you have to follow the ropes, go back to base camp, and you're done. You know, you cannot risk another 20 people in this group because you want to go someplace, but you're not capable. Your body is giving out. There were people that started coughing, which is a symptom of being without sufficient oxygen. And also the idea that you had to carry oxygen up the mountainside beside yourself and climbing up these steep inclines, also having to carry enough oxygen for you to breathe, which is a lot of weight, the metal containers and et cetera. So, it's very difficult. But anyway, as these people began to have problems, they should have said, okay, yeah, I cannot go on. It's for the benefit of the group. I have to turn back and taken on the responsibility for themselves based on the benefit of the group. And none of them did that. And for that reason, a lot of them had some serious medical problems at the end as a result of the climb. Five of them died because they did not work in terms of a group. There was supposed to be oxygen for them in places. It was disorganized. And when they got to certain checkpoints, there was no oxygen for them. And, so there was disaster after disaster after disaster because of poor planning, bad decisions, and the leader of the group losing control, where individuals wanted to do what they wanted to do. And that's probably the biggest issue, is that the individuals were only thinking about themselves. So how does this translate into a real survival situation? That is, you have to, number one, be prepared. Number two, you cannot let other people into the group. Typically small groups of 4 or 5 people are maximum. If you're in an emergency situation, you should have already have communication with your people who would be in your group to meet at a certain designated location. And each one of those persons is responsible for getting to that location from wherever they are. The one worst thing that can happen is, okay, everybody gets to your location. And all of a sudden, where's so-and-so? Or, grandma's across town, we got to go get her. That's where things break down. Because now someone has to leave the group that's in what might be called a relatively safe area, has to leave, go out into whatever the catastrophic situation is. They have to leave, cross through this to try and locate a person where in a lot of cases they wouldn't even know where they were, and then try and bring them back. And so, I mean, there's a faint possibility of success. But in a catastrophic situation, it's pretty much minimal. So the leaving, once the people are at the site, leaving for some reason to go get another person and come back, now that person is going to be out in trouble. Now a next person has to leave to go try and save that person. So you can see all of a sudden this thing breaks down into a catastrophic mess. And communication is important before all of this happens, to have a policy that, no, you have to be responsible for getting yourself back here to the safe area, because we can't risk other people going out to try and find you because you were not responsible enough to take care of yourself and get back here. It's not a personal choice. It's a matter of respect. And respect for the rest of the group, so that they don't have to go out and save you because you just decided to wait or do something different. You have to have a plan, you have to follow the plan, and everybody has to follow the plan. I think it's excellent that we're no longer in this era of people having the attitude that they have to prepare against the government. I think those attitudes have subsided a great deal. They're probably still there, and we don't know what's going to happen in the future, but under the Obama regime, it was the gun sales were through the ceiling, ammunition sales were off the charts. In a lot of cases, it was very difficult to get ammunition, because people were literally preparing for a government siege on them. You know, the listening, the classification of people who had religious ties as enemies of the state, or if they had land or holdings, that they would be stolen by the state or be invaded, because those were very real issues. We were seeing it happen. We were seeing the Bundys and the Hammonds up in Washington. You were seeing people being burned out by government agencies. I mean, it was bad. Now, that has not happened since Trump has been in office. And that was going to get, by the way, a lot worse had somebody else been moved into the presidential office. Okay, so anyway, enough about this, but once again, I think this is a good movie to watch, Everest, and watch the breakdown of control, the breakdown of authority, the breakdown where people in the group looked at their own interests above that of the safety of the group. And, they should have realized that, you know, I can't see good, or I'm too cold, or I'm losing energy, I'm out of oxygen, I have to go back down. And instead of thinking, well, I paid all this money and I want to get to the top, I'm going to do this. Nobody thought about the group, the benefit of the group. And when the leader said, you got to go back down, they didn't. They kept going. And literally, a lot of people died because of that. So you could take that same scenario where people would go back down and nobody would have died. So very telling. I think that's a good case study in exactly what not to do. Okay. So just a couple of words here. I'm back to normal here now. If people with paid casts, I'll be getting those posted again. I missed some here over the past month because of the XPRIZE, which took me into the end of October, and literally just getting kind of back to normal in the early part of November. So anyway, so the water filters on the webpage still there, all my books, etc. And the wing generator, I've got a lot of updating to do on various web pages, a lot of emails to catch up on, things moving, all good, which is amazing given my advanced age. And, I'm not exactly a spring chicken anymore, but I probably do more in a day than most other people combined. I have a lot of good things going on, and other old studies that actually took a back seat once the XPRIZE issue started. Be getting back to those also very soon. So a lot of work, but a very successful year and a half, actually, since I started that XPRIZE. It was in May of 2017, actually, earlier. But a lot of progress, and very important progress on the wing generator, on the water situation, and to help people in the world to solve those two major problems. So just once again, the webpage, jmccsci.com. Go there, and if you haven't joined the paid cast yet, join up. And I'm right now in the middle of the lectures on the weather book. Those are very important lectures. I'm doing those from the historical perspective that someday, in 100 years, these will be the essential beginning of people's education regarding outer space. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.